Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo and Kelly Jean Kelly. But first, this report.
There are many things for students in the United States to consider when thinking about which college or university to attend. This includes the location of the school, whether it is in a big city or the countryside, the size of the student population, and even how well known the school is. But as the cost of U.S. higher education keeps rising, another consideration for many students is return on investment. Not all colleges and universities require a lot of money for a student's education. But at some schools, students can expect to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars within the normal 4 to 6 year study period. If they have to spend that much, students want to know what they can expect to earn in their chosen career field. In 2013, then U.S. President Barack Obama's administration launched an online tool to help students decide which college or university to attend. It is a Department of Education-operated website called College Scorecard. The department created the website as a database for all kinds of information on schools across the country. It lists information on yearly costs, average student debt, completion rates, and expected job earnings. The Obama administration put all this data in one place as a way of providing answers to questions about higher education. We know students and families often feel they lack the tools to decide which school is right for them, noted then Secretary of Education Ernie Duncan. Critics raised questions about whether the data treated all schools fairly and whether it was helping some schools but not others. Some were concerned that the website was designed only for students receiving financial aid from the federal government. And others argued that the data failed to demonstrate the student experience at some schools.
But generally speaking, College Scorecard has been a very useful tool for Americans wanting to make informed decisions about higher education. So says Caitlin Vitez, Higher Education Campaign Director for the U.S. Public Interest Research Group. The group, also known as U.S. PIRG, is an alliance of activist nonprofit organizations across the country and in Canada. Recently, the administration of President Donald Trump made a change to the College Scorecard that critics say limits its usefulness. In September, the Department of Education removed all the national median data from the website. The national median data provided the national average for any of the qualities and groupings listed on the College Scorecard. For example, if users looked at the debt they could expect to take on from studying at a given school, they would also see the overall average for all the schools in the system. This gave students at least some kind of general comparison when weighing costs and expected results, said U.S. PIRG's Caitlin Vitez. She added that without this information, students might not be able to tell if a school is successfully serving students as well as others. Vitez noted there are other ways for comparing the return on investment from colleges and universities, but some publications give more attention to schools that are well known and respected, but not necessarily the best value. Vitez said the current administration would want to limit this kind of information because of its support for for-profit higher education. The Obama administration took legal action against several for-profit schools, accusing them of wrongdoing. Vitez said the current Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, has taken steps to remove rules that she considers harmful to the for-profit higher education industry. This includes announcing plans to cancel a rule requiring schools to ensure that their graduates find good-paying jobs.
Vitez told VOA, "If we're not going to be holding these schools accountable for all those really important metrics, and we're also not going to show that some of the schools are not a good choice for students, that doesn't serve the public interest." But the Department of Education argues that the national median data has serious problems and is not that clear. In a written statement, a department spokesperson noted that the national medians were established with data from every school receiving federal money. The official argued it is unfair to compare all schools with the same measures, as many colleges and universities are very different in important ways. For example, a selective school that serves mostly wealthy students will have different outcomes than a school that mainly serves poor communities. Comparing these two types of institutions is meaningless, the spokesperson wrote. Institutional selectivity has a significant impact on institutional outcomes, and therefore, the most appropriate comparisons are between institutions that serve similar students and have similar admissions criteria. However, even some supporters of Secretary DeVos and her efforts find the change in the college scorecard troubling.
Daniel Elkins is the legislative director for the Enlisted Association of the National Guard of the United States. His organization represents the interests of thousands of members of the U.S. Armed Forces. Elkins says his group was pleased with recent actions by DeVos, including the plan to remove the employment guarantee rule. He argues it does not correctly punish all the schools guilty of underserving their students. However, he said, the removal of national median data is a move in the complete opposite direction from where the department should be heading. Elkins notes that many armed forces members who seek a college or university education are non-traditional students. This means they are likely the first in their families to go to college and may have little money of their own. He noted that their families may not be able to help them financially or have experience with higher education. The U.S. military offers financial aid for education to some of its members, but many of them often need to take out loans to help pay for college. Elkins and Vitez agree any lack of knowledge can lead them to borrowing from bad lenders or attending bad schools. And the special tools the military uses to help members find good schools depend on information from college scorecard, including national medians. If you do not have anything to compare it to, you don't understand what's out there, said Elkins. Then you have to compare multiple graphs, multiple charts, and try and figure out an average on your own. In October, Elkins' organization released a joint statement with several other military veterans groups. They asked the Department of Education to return national medians to the college scorecard by mid-November. The information has yet to return to the website. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. On this show, we explore language. Where do expressions come from? And how do we use them? For today's show, we go down on the farm. The dairy farm, to be exact. Many female animals, such as cows and goats, produce milk for their young. Cream is the fat in milk. And we use cream from farm animals to make many tasty foods. We also use cream in some really great expressions. Let's start with the best of the best, the cream of the crop. When you let milk sit, cream rises to the top. The cream is considered to be the best tasting part of milk. So if something is the cream of the crop, it is the best of its kind. For example, if the apples from a farm near my house are the best, I could say they are the cream of the crop. But English speakers use this expression for just about anything, not just food or drink. We can describe people this way. For example, the students listed at the top of their class are generally the cream of the crop. The noun cream has been used to mean the best since the 16th century. The French expression La crème de la crème means the cream of the cream, and it came into use in English by the year 1800. These days, we commonly use crème de la crème in informal, everyday speech. You can often hear Americans say this, even if they have never spoken French in their lives. For some reason, they drop the first article, la. Well, the reason could be perhaps that they do not actually speak French. Now back to foods. Cream is used in many foods. Naturally, you need cream to make a cream puff. A cream puff is a light and delicate pastry filled with sweet cream. They are a popular treat and can be very delicious. Outside of the bakery, however, cream puffs can also describe a person. If you call a man a cream puff, you are saying he is weak, both physically and mentally. And he is really not that good at anything. Now, a cream puff you get from the bakery is delicate and can fall apart easily. So when talking about a woman, a cream puff is a delicate female. I know she doesn't really want to stay. Be careful how you hold her. Please don't ever scold her. She's my cream puff. However, I would not suggest calling a woman a cream puff. It's best to leave the cream puffs in the bakery. Talking about baked goods, many are made with butter, and butter comes from cream. You start with a bowl filled with fresh cream. If you beat the cream again and again, you will get butter. Many dessert recipes call for mixing or creaming butter with other ingredients, like sugar. Creaming butter is an important part of making some foods. It can take some time and arm strength to cream butter, especially if it is cold. You must beat and beat the butter until it becomes soft. So it is not surprising that when you get creamed in real life, you get beaten badly. You can get creamed in a sporting event. If your basketball team loses by 30 points, you guys got creamed. Usually there is an opponent who creams you. So if you do poorly on a test, you would not say you got creamed. That would mean you were competing against other students and they won. We also use the term creamed when talking about a physical beating. So if someone beats you up, which we hope will never happen, you could say that person creamed you. That is terrible and we are so sorry. But maybe the person who creamed you is a good friend. They apologized and now everything seems better. You could say that everything between you is now peaches and cream. This means a situation that started off badly or was going badly is now very much improved. Here is another example, and this one does not involve anyone getting beat up. Let's say a new business got off to a bad start. The office space was in poor shape. The product launch failed, and several investors pulled out. But now, a year later, the company is turning a profit. The offices are beautiful, and all the investors are happy. Everything is peaches and cream. Peaches and cream is also used to describe a woman's skin. This means her skin is creamy, clear, and soft. Which is strange when you think about it. Peaches are usually yellowish-orange and a little fuzzy. That would mean someone with peaches and cream skin would look a little orange and a little hairy. But it doesn't mean that. As we often say, English is funny that way. And that's Words and Their Stories. I'm Ana Mateo.
Your final return will not diminish, and you can be the cream of the crop.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about George Walker Bush. He took office in 2001 as the 43rd president. He has a similar name to another president, his father, George Herbert Walker Bush. To simplify things, Americans sometimes call the younger Bush 43, or simply W. Here we will just call him Bush. Because Bush is a recent president, historians have not reached a broad agreement on his time as a leader. But he will surely be remembered for facing one of the biggest challenges to any president, the attacks against the U.S. on September 11, 2001. George Bush was born in the northeast state of Connecticut, but his parents soon moved to the southwest state of Texas. George grew up there and considered Texas home. The Bush family had a long background in politics. Bush's grandfather was a senator. His father held many public offices. In some ways, George was prepared for a career in politics, too. He went to the same private boarding school as his father. Then, like his father and grandfather, George went to Yale for college. He also worked on several political campaigns, but he said he did not consider pursuing politics. Instead, he earned a degree in business at Harvard and took a job in an oil company in Texas. In time, he founded his own oil business. And he married Laura Welch, who was a teacher and librarian in their hometown. They had twin daughters named Barbara and Jenna. In these years as a young adult, Bush began to make some changes. He began attending a Christian church regularly. He decided to stop drinking alcohol because it was creating problems in his personal life, and he turned his attention to politics. Bush lost the first election in which he competed, a race to become a member of Congress. So, for a while, he focused on business investments and helping his father's political career. But in 1992, his father lost re-election to the presidency, and the younger Bush saw a chance to enter politics himself again. In 1994, Bush ran for governor of Texas. To many people's surprise, he won. 4 years later, he was overwhelmingly re-elected. Many voters liked his image as what he called a compassionate conservative. In other words, he wanted to use traditional Republican ideas about government to help society. Following two successful terms as governor, Bush turned his attention to the presidency. In 2000, he competed against the vice president at the time, Al Gore. The winner was not announced until more than a month following the election. Usually, the winner is announced within hours. Both sides disputed the process of counting votes in the state of Florida. Finally, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on the process. The court ordered state officials to stop recounting votes. Bush's lead stood. Bush entered office expecting to bring many of the ideas he pursued in Texas to the entire nation. For example, as president, he permitted religious groups to receive government funding and set national standards for public schools. These moves were popular with many voters, but they also challenged some American traditions. The separation of church and state and the ability of public schools to govern themselves. For many presidents, these policies might have created a legacy. But early in Bush's term, he faced a crisis that defined much of his time in office. Hijackers linked to the Al-Qaeda group seized four airplanes on September 11, 2001. They purposely crashed two planes into the twin towers of the World Trade Center in New York City, eventually killing more than 2,700 people. Another plane was flown into the Pentagon, the country's military headquarters outside of Washington, D.C. About 200 people died there. The fourth plane was aimed at another important target. But passengers fought the hijackers. The plane lost control and crashed in a field in Pennsylvania. All 44 people on board died there. President Bush was visiting an elementary school in Florida that morning. He learned about the attacks while he was reading with the children. At the end of the day, Bush spoke to the nation. He said, the U.S. would answer both the terrorist groups and the countries that permitted terrorist groups to thrive. Over the next years, Bush took a number of actions to create a new national security strategy. They included creating a Department of Homeland Security, making changes to the country's intelligence operations, and reforming the U.S. military. He also sent U.S. forces into Afghanistan to destroy terrorist networks there. Bush was especially targeting the person who had designed the September 11 terrorist attacks, Osama bin Laden. The struggle in Afghanistan was successful at first, but continued throughout Bush's time in office. And bin Laden was not captured while Bush was president. In 2003, Bush opened another front on what some called the War on Terror. He and other government officials said the leader of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, was developing weapons that could kill many people. They said Hussein and his connections to terrorist groups threatened Americans and people in other countries. Hussein did not agree to leave Iraq. So U.S. and British forces launched bombs at targets in the country's capital. Additional troops destroyed what was left of the targets. Hussein was quickly overthrown. But the weapons of mass destruction were not found. For the rest of Bush's presidency, U.S. forces remained in Iraq. Bush promised that Americans would stabilize the country and help Iraqis create a democratic government. The presidency of George W. Bush is too recent to understand its impact. But there is some evidence of the public's reaction at the time. Bush received some of the highest ratings of any president. In the weeks following the September 11 attacks, 90% approved of his leadership. He was re-elected in 2004. But his popularity steadily decreased. At the end of his second term, he had one of the lowest public approval ratings of any president, 33%. The U.S. economy had entered a recession. More Americans disagreed, especially with his decision to invade Iraq, and some criticized his government for responding too slowly after Hurricane Katrina struck New Orleans and the country's Gulf Coast. Since Bush left the White House in 2009, his approval ratings have, like those of many presidents, risen again. He has mostly avoided public appearances. Instead, he has enjoyed playing sports, helping charities, and reading U.S. history. He also began a new hobby, painting. He has created portraits of dozens of veterans to honor their service in the military. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.